From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. José Sartorelli, Chancellor of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, took the helm 3 years ago, in 2015. Chancellor Sartorelli comes to Wilmington from West Virginia University, where he was the Dean of the College of Business and Economics. He was named WVU's first Chief Global Officer in 2013. Prior to his foray into higher education, the Chancellor worked with Johnson & Johnson as Pharmaceutical Group Chairman for Asia Pacific, Japan, and Latin America. He also worked for Eli Lilly and Company for 5 years in Asia. In 2015, he told us that fostering diversity on campus was high on the agenda. He also pointed to the creation of a strategic plan as one of his more urgent priorities. He's faced some challenges, including serious heart surgery earlier this year and devastating damage to the campus from Hurricane Florence. Today, we'll find out how he's doing on some of those fronts, what's in the strategic plan, and what he's learned over the last 3 years, including the challenges he still faces. Chancellor Sartorelli, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Today's interview is pre-recorded, and need to start with a national story about a space launch that is going to happen later this afternoon, what will actually be several days ago by the time this interview airs. UNCW professor John Morrison's nanosatellite Seahawk 1 is ready for launch. It's part of a rideshare mission from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And this Seahawk 1 is a groundbreaking ocean color sensor created by Professor Morrison at the UNCW Center for Marine Science. What's the significance for UNCW?
I think it's very significant. I think, you know, we have several areas where UNCW has become very, not only substantial, and marine science and marine biology is one of them. And in addition to that, obviously, creative writing, chemistry, nursing, we're in the largest nursing schools in the state, et cetera. But going back to the satellite, I think, you know, we do a lot of investigation. We track, we're all about the oceans and the coast, and we use buoys, we use vessels, et cetera. But when you use vessels and buoys, you are very geographically limited. And so you're covering, you know, thousands of miles, but we're very close to the coast and so on and so forth. With the satellite now and up in space and in a low orbit, but a significant orbit, it's going to allow us to do, you know, tracking and quote unquote and following the oceans worldwide, so to speak, globally, and that is very exciting. And not too many, you know, programs, marine science or otherwise, have been able to do that in the past. And Dr. John Morrison has been a terrific researcher in that respect, and he found a way to do that. And I think it places us in a very special position. A very unique position as one of the universities now with that capability. It's almost like what I keep referring now to marine science from space, which is, you know, it's an oxymoron, so to speak. But it's you know, you've got to go with technology, and I think that's going to lead us into many, many very attractive ways, not only for the sake of science and research and findings and discovery, but also for the sake of our students to be able to participate in this process in the program. And so I'm very excited about it, and I hope Seahawk 1 will be one of many in the future. So we shall see.
And, of course, Hurricane Florence had some serious impacts on the UNCW campus, not just right to the school schedule, but also to buildings on campus, including impacting the science department. Can you tell us what happened and where you are now with the mitigation of that?
Right. I was temporarily evacuated. I came back and after the 15th, 16th of September, and the campus had been hit hard. Fortunately, it was not a category 2 or 3 or 4, and so that certainly was fortunate for us. But we had close to 400 trees down. We had power down. We had inaccessibility to many areas of the campus because of the trees and so on and so forth. So and plus, we had at least three or four or five dorm locations affected. Galloway was affected, which is our oldest dorm on campus. Our 13 apartment buildings were affected dramatically, so much so that we were not able to recover those buildings, and they're down closed. And then academic-wise, we had three buildings that really suffered a lot. One was Dobo Hall, where most of our our research labs are located, chemistry and biology mostly, as well as Luzzi. That's more of a it's a major academic building for the social sciences in general. Cameron Hall, where we have the business school, et cetera, and many other buildings. But those are the ones that were most affected. So we were, at the end of the day, we were not able to recover the 13 apartment buildings. We closed them down. And in that location now, we're going to be building a $145 million project for 18 new beds starting hopefully in January. It's a public-private partnership.
Is not funded then by money from FEMA or
no,
the state?
No, this is totally separate. And then Luzzi Hall was, we were able to recover it, brought back to life. And we did the same with Cameron Hall. But Dobo was impossible. Dobo, it's a very large facility with over 100 professors resided there and 38 or 40 labs. And the water came in from the top. At the very top of Dobo, it's a flat roof, and that roof was covered with rubber membrane. The membranes came out and opened up a big hole. And that big hole took in, 25 to 34 inches of water over 3 days. And so it flooded most of the second floor and parts of the first floor.
And again, these are not just classrooms. These are labs that also house important equipment for the science department.
Important equipment. So it's equipment affected. It's, classrooms affected. It's labs, chemicals, and all of that. So obviously from the very beginning, the mantra was safety comes first, safety to our students, to our employees, to our visitors. And so the eventual conclusion was we're going to close down Dobo. We're going to move everything that we can out to other facilities. The Center for Marine Science is one of the places where we move some of that out to. And then Friday Hall is another hall that we have on campus that we moved it to. So
how are you rebuilding in a way then that takes into account this the impacts of climate change as storms become more severe and more frequent?
Yeah, and first, we're bringing in now some mobile units in January for the spring semester. These mobile units are labs on wheels, so to speak, and we're going to be renting those facilities, about 20,000 square feet worth of it. And then at the same time, across the street from where the university is, across from South College, we're building two buildings to between 40 and 60,000 square feet of space. We're going to replicate in those two new buildings, new metal structures, temporary metal structures, it may be permanent, but temporary now. We'll replicate all the labs that we currently have in Dobo. And at the same time, in parallel, we're rebuilding Dobo. Now, Dobo is going to take between a year and a half to 2 years to fix. We're also going to, at the same time that we're doing that, we're making sure that we harden the infrastructure of the university. I like to have most of the critical buildings with roofs that can withstand 135 miles an hour or higher, so that we can sustain and be resilient in case of a Category 3 or Category 4, which is coming. We had a major, in the history of this, we had a major hurricane back in 1930s. Then we have Hazel in 54, which is a major one. And then we had, Florence, and we'll have others, and that's going to be a problem, and we want to make sure that...
And, of course, acknowledging that anthropogenic, human-caused climate change is a factor here.
Right. Well, regardless of whether caused by humans or not, and it probably is, the issue is that we have to address it. If you're going to live close to the coast, we have to have an infrastructure that is that is capable of sustaining high winds, lots of water, et cetera. And so I think that's we have to be prepared for that. And I think I want to prepare the university to avoid a devastating hit. Like, for example, you look at what happened to Florida recently. We want to make sure that we have a university that's sustainable, that stays with us. And for that, we need to harness and harden the infrastructure of the university.
And considering that UNCW is known internationally for
right.
marine science and
right.
And does have a thriving science program, your own professor John Morrison, who's watching his launch of Seahawk 1, said of
right.
the satellite, the data collected will improve our ability to monitor coastal environments where anthropogenic stresses like red tides are often
sure.
most acute. Does UNCW have a role now in working to combat human-caused climate change?
I think, as a university, I think we do have a major role to play, which is to advance research and to advance explanation to the phenomena that's happening. And so the role is one of more information, more data, more facts, and I hope we continue to do that. And I think Dr. Morrison and others have done that very well and will continue to do so.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with UNCW Chancellor José Sartorelli. When we come back from this break, we'll find out how he's doing on one of the priorities he held up 3 years ago as key, diversity. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's a conversation with the Chancellor of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. José Sartorelli has served in that role since mid-2015, and today we're learning about some of the challenges he's faced then and what's at the top of his agenda for 2019. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. And Chancellor Sartorelli, before we get back into the conversation about diversity, as that was one of your main priorities 3 years ago, can we talk about the pronunciation of your first name? Because this is something that when we met 3 years ago, you were very clear with me. And we rehearsed, and I know I'm still not getting it exactly right, but we rehearsed José,
right.
You're from Brazil.
Brazil, and we speak Portuguese, yeah.
Yes, and then since then, I frequently hear people in other capacities referring to you as José Sartorelli.
Right.
And you even, in your interview with our producer, Rachel Keith, referred to yourself as José Sartorelli.
Right.
So what's going on there?
What's going on?
How do we pronounce your name?
Now, I think the reason why sometimes I've given in to the Spanish pronunciation of José, which is José, is because it's easier for people to understand it and to spell it. And so if I say José, many times they will start asking questions to how to spell it. And so I kind of made it easier on people by just saying José. José is the Spanish pronunciation of José, but in Portuguese it's José, like the way I'm pronouncing it. The J in Spanish is, it's like, right? It's José, Ho, whereas in Portuguese it's Jo, José instead of José. And so, that's the reason why, but I accept either way. It's fine. I'd have no problem with that.
You're very generous about that.
Yeah. Well, I think you've got to be adaptive, most people in this country, a lot of people in this country speak Spanish, and therefore for them it would be easier to say José instead of José, And so that's what I do. Yeah.
Now, when we spoke 3 years ago, you said diversity was an important prong for you, part of a right. strategic plan. And you, I think, then specifically talked about increasing the number of international students at the university. How have you approached the topic of diversity on campus, since we know that there is still that underground term that's not really a secret? People call UNCW UNC white.
Right.
Still very white.
Well, it's important to give the context to this. In 2000, 18 years ago, only 9% of our student population was non-white. That number today is 22%. So we've made a lot of progress. Are we there already? No, we're not there. We probably like to have more Hispanics, more African Americans, more Asians, et cetera, come to our school. But we're not going to get into the debate as to the polemic of what is the right number. I have no idea what the number is, the right number is. Is that a number that matches the makeup of demographic makeup of the county, the city, the state, the United States, or what?
What do you think it is? If you had to really use something as a model, what would that model be?
The model should be one that appeal and without thinking of social engineering here, appeal and respond to demand that's coming to us. And so I think that the demand for more education for Hispanics is increasing. The demand for more education for African Americans is increasing, and we have to respond to that, and we're going to respond to that. I would suspect that a number in the 30s is probably more representative of the population. But, this is not a question of importing people just for the heck of matching up a utopic number, because we're not going to accomplish much by doing that. But there's another point here that's very important, and that is I want to make sure that diversity happens at the university, but that we have the same graduation rates for the various peoples that we bring in. And we're very proud of the fact that this is a university. About 2 years ago, Education Trust is an organization, think tank, that ran an analysis of how much the universities have closed the gap of graduation rates between the races. And so we came out of almost 300 universities in the country, number 8th best in terms of closing that gap of graduation rates between African Americans, Hispanics, and whites.
To what do you attribute that?
I think we bring in students. We are selective, but not over-selective. And it was once they come in, we spend a lot of time, our professors particularly, with these students to make sure that they pass exams, they apply themselves to the subject matter, and they succeed. It's all about the number of advisors that we have has been increased significantly because of that and for other reasons. And so, the worst that can happen today is for a student is to come and eventually take on a bunch of debt and not graduate. And so I want to avoid as much as possible of that. And there's no, we could have a lot more diversity. But if I get a lot more diversity and they're not graduating, I defeated the purpose, right? It's worse than before. So we want to make sure that we do this thoughtfully. We bring in the right numbers of people that we can accommodate, that we can advise properly, and that they graduate quickly in 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, and that there should not be much of a difference between whether you were white or African-American or Hispanic as to whether you're going to graduate in 4 years or 5 years or 6 years. That is very critical for me. Going forward, is to increase diversity, but also increase it so that people are graduating on time.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with the Chancellor of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, José Sartorelli. Today's interview is pre-recorded. The report recommending what to do with the Confederate statue, Silent Sam, which was toppled earlier this year on the UNC campus, is coming out this week. Duke University also has decided to rename one of its buildings, named after white supremacist Julian Carr. How do you think universities within the UNC system should be handling this part of their history and dealing with it in the context of today and this idea of diversity and respect for all people?
Right. Well, I do think that each university has its own history. We have a history, obviously, of 71 years now, and that's, you know, we do not have on campus or otherwise many of the quote-unquote monuments and depictions of other universities in the system, and therefore it does not affect us directly. In fact, the only thing we've got on campus of significance reminding us very much of the past is an old cannon just close to Hoggard, and it's a non-entity, so to speak. But I do believe that it is a very tough issue, and it's tough in the sense that how do you balance history without, washing it away, so to speak, and keeping it a semblance of what used to be, not necessarily to honor it, but to remind people, you know, it's like Santayana, I think it was the great philosopher, used to say, if you don't know history or the past, you like to repeat it. So how do we do that? That all of a sudden you're going to have a campus that's aseptic, has no resemblance of anything, and it's perfect. But at the same time, I think if we're going to keep a monument of any kind, it has to be almost for an educational purpose, so to speak, that people are reminded of things of now on what not to do, so to speak. And so it's a very controversial issue. It's a tough one. If you support the maintenance, you're going to be accused. If you support the elimination, you're going to be accused. How would I handle it? I think I would probably handle it by making sure that people understand that we have to address the historical context. And if we want to turn the campuses and everything else, for that matter, into an aseptic place where nothing is recorded, nothing is registered, nothing is quoted, movies are changed because they depict things which are not acceptable, it's going to be a very different world. And I'm not sure if I want to live in a world like that either. I want to make sure that we have a world that is sensitive to the differences among people, that the good things are honored and the bad things are not honored. And how do we do that?
On that front, I think it was earlier this year, you sent an email affirming support for DACA students, deferred right. action for childhood arrivals, right. when there were questions about whether they were going to retain their protected status. But right. what else caused you? What kinds of questions or behaviors were you concerned about that caused you to send that email and remind people that these people are important members of the campus community?
Right. Well, I do think that our political system has not addressed this issue. I do believe that immigration is a major, I'm an immigrant to this country, a legal immigrant to this country. And I hope that we could build a system where everyone wanted to this country could come legally to this country. I'm not a spouser of, well, you know, there's people cannot be legal or illegal. People, that is not the case. That is totally unreality, right? I just got back from the UK and Gibraltar, and I can tell you, I would not be able to get in if I didn't show my passport as I was going in. And if I go to China, if I go to Brazil, if I go to any place around the world, you've got to show your papers. And so that's one side of it. So how do we focus on making sure that we observe? This is a country of laws. How do we make sure that we have laws that people observe? So the first thing to do, I think, is to make sure that Congress acts and thoughtfully passes law which will contemplate a strong support of legal immigration, making sure that there's no reason for people to go illegal if they want to come to this country. How do we do that? That is the real debate. I think immigration has been good for this country from the very beginning. We're all immigrants, after all, right? But how do you do it so that there's a sense of law and order and there's a sense of legality that people feel that, okay, I want to come to this country as an aspiration. I wanted to come to this country because I had that as an aspiration. And I wanted to come and I wanted to participate in this country and be part of the life of this country. I wanted to assimilate into the culture of this country. And I value the culture of this country. I didn't come to this country because I did not value the culture of this country. And that became my country. And so how do we do that? You know, if you go back to Ted Roosevelt in 1919, he talked about assimilation. And today, if you say assimilation, people go crazy, right? They go crazy about assimilation. But the truth of the matter is the following. If I'm coming to a country like the U.S., I want to live by the laws of the U.S. I want to learn about the culture. That doesn't mean I'm going to give up on my culture. I'm going to keep my culture. But I'm also going to, quote unquote, live the new culture that I've chosen to come to. And so that's part of that discussion that has to be taken. But I would like to have Congress act so they could turn, encourage everyone who wants to come to this country to live and to prosper and to help to build this great country to do it legally. How can we do it?
UNCW Chancellor Sartorelli, earlier this year you underwent some pretty serious heart surgery. How did that go and how are you doing now?
Yes, it was kind of preventative. I did not have a heart attack or anything like that. But I was starting to feel, tired after walking or playing tennis, et cetera. And I decided to check, and we found out that four of my arteries were substantially clogged, and we could not even do stenting. And so the option was to go for a bypass, and we did a quadruple bypass. I did some cardiac rehab afterwards, and it's going terrific. I think it's worked very well. I feel a lot better. There's more blood being pumped to my heart, so to speak. That's exactly what it does. And so I feel real good at it. And I've changed my diet. Being from Brazil, I'm a very strong carnivorous, or used to be, and so I'm eating not meat anymore, and I'm eating all the other stuff that are also
Are you
good.
A vegetarian now?
Well, I'm a vegetarian if you include fish in that, yes.
A pescatarian.
Pescatarian.
Okay.
Because, when I came out, some people told me, so look, you cannot eat anything that have a mother or have eyes. I said, well, that's not possible, right? So so I'm eating things that have eyes and who have and also have mothers, I guess.
Fair enough. A graduate student was recently telling me about submitting an instructor evaluation, which is something that students do at the end of the term.
Right.
And she says that the new evaluation is remarkably shorter than previous years. And we interviewed another professor on Coastline earlier this year who talked about the importance of these student evaluations and how they impact a professor's possible future at the institution, including their income. What role do these student evaluations play in professors' careers and salaries?
The professor is normally evaluated on three things normally. Research, or teaching first, research and service. And so those are the typical evaluations that the professors go through. The teaching evaluation is done, a lot of it, a good portion of it is done through surveys and, questionnaires to the students, et cetera. In other assessments, but that's the core. Temporarily, in fact, for the fall, our faculty senate opted to go easy on that evaluation because there was so much stuff, both on the faculty side and on the student side, so much pressure, so much volatility.
Are you talking about the accelerated schedule because of Hurricane
Florence?
Right,
the accelerated schedule and the compressed schedule, because we basically compressed 15 weeks of teaching and instruction to 11, right? So they opted to say, okay, we should, not eliminate, but be a lot more sensitive to the use of that during this semester.
And does that include the weight that you give it?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And so, but coming January, we're back on track, and we're going to be, you know, asking students to evaluate their professors.
So how do you account then for the disgruntled student who knows he's not going to do well in this course, even though they happen before final exams?
Right.
But he's, you know, just whatever reason, he doesn't like the way the teacher dresses, or he doesn't like the speech patterns
right.
of the teacher. How do you account for that?
Well, look, in anything in life, in this case included, you've got to have a few systems in place that can track certain things. And so you cannot track everything. And there's always going to be disgruntled professors and also disgruntled students. But I believe that if it's all about consistency, if we are consistent about it and that we continue to ask the same questions over and over again, I think we'll probably give a fair shake to both professors and the students. And by the way, you know, the chairs, as they evaluate the students, are also sensitive. We're not getting just that document, the questionnaire. The evaluating questionnaire is the ultimate only document that's used. We're also getting comments. You know, we're getting comments. We're getting emails. You know, this is a very... The world of today is a very communicative world. You know, it's not for lack of communication that we don't get information. People talk, and they talk a lot today because of social media. So we're getting a lot of other information that either helps to elucidate and to make that evaluation of that professor more accurate or not.
And you've actually identified social media as one of the challenges
yes.
on a university campus.
Yes.
And I know we're going to have to go to break. So when we come back, I want to hear more about
okay.
why that's such a challenge and how you're managing that.
Right.
You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It's a conversation with UNCW Chancellor José Sartorelli. He took the helm in 2015, now 3.5 years into his leadership. We're learning more about the vision he has for the campus, what changes he wants to make, and some of the challenges he faces. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It's a conversation with UNCW Chancellor José Sartorelli, who took the helm of UNCW in 2015. We're checking in 3.5 years into his leadership. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. Just before we went to break, we touched on the how social media can impact the public conversation, especially on a university campus. What challenges have you faced with that? Because you actually have said that you've had to develop a thicker skin. Tell us about that.
Right, right. Well, you know, in a growing university like ours, we're up to almost 17,000 students, some of the best SATs in the state, some of the best graduation rates in the state. This is a top institution in the state. But the issue of on one hand of social media has to do also with this whole idea of the university is the marketplace of ideas. How do we make sure that we preserve free speech and freedom of expression on one hand, and at the same time do it in a way that's possible for people to not to get into fistfights? And so that's why the other requirement, which is very important to us, and that is how do you treat people with dignity and respect? And it's kind of people say, well, you know, this is old stuff. No, it's not old stuff. You know, we may become, you know, we may send men to Mars or to the moon or have, marine science done from space, but you have to treat people with dignity and with respect. And I emphasize that very much. You cannot just have free speech on one hand and not do it with dignity and respect. You've got to have both. And I, whenever I meet freshmen and transfer students or graduate students, I had a meeting this morning with all of my coaches. We talk about that, the importance of dignity and respect, and preserving free speech is very important. And free speech sometimes it's tough because it's it may be ugly or it may be in disagreement with what you think. But this is part of the system. This is, you know, it's First Amendment, right? There are four things in the First Amendment. One of them is free speech. And so that the preservation of that is very important for the very preservation of democracy in this country as such. But at the same time, you have to do with dignity and respect. And
so,
media,
so what did you tell your coaches then specifically about how to foster an atmosphere of dignity and respect?
I think it's an approach to life where you say, look, I've got to listen to people. I've got to not be offensive. If you become a provocateur just because you want to impress people or harm people or whatever or offend people, then you're not going to accomplish anything. You know, unfortunately, you only accomplish things when you get agreements on things, on people. It's almost leadership. I talk to them about leadership. How do you become a leader is that you get people to follow you. And you have to have a vision, but you have to do that with treating people with dignity and respect, and there's no other way. There's just no other way. Now, what happens on social media is that people get behind their, quote-unquote, their devices, and they say a bunch of stuff that may be hurtful and that you cannot respond to, or it may be inaccurate that you cannot respond to. Back in the old days when you had to do that by either verbally, face-to-face, or through a letter, that was different, right? To write a letter, you have to think about writing the letter. But nowadays, people just, you know, they tweet. Well, tweet 24 or 44 characters or 100 characters or whatever, and that's it. And so there's no consequence to anything. There's just people put out. I can tell you, I get emails that are just ugly as they come, horrible. And I never felt that I deserve as a person my character, that I deserve that kind of name being used by people trying to offend me, trying to hurt me. And that is the type of stuff, that's the downside of social media. On the other hand, social media is beautiful, right? Allows people to get together, to share stuff, to organize themselves more effectively, et cetera. So there's a lot of positives, but there's some real negative ones. Now, can we improve that? I think we can. We can, you know, let's use the same things that our parents taught us of respect for people and dignity, as you're doing social media, and it's going to be great if you do it.
UNCW Chancellor Sartorelli, I want to go back to the idea of diversity on campus for a moment. David Gessner, a creative writing professor and department chair, wrote a piece that was published in September in The American Scholar, comparing the experience of a middle-aged white guy, his experience, to that of a UNCW student who is African American. And Gessner notes his freedom to go anywhere without being questioned. He chronicles incidents on campus when this black student named Will, I'm going to read from his piece here, quote, more than once has been featured in promotional photos on the school's website that are meant to boost our image and, to pardon the expression, whitewash the fact that the school is not fully integrated, end quote. So the student, Will, was stopped on campus a couple of times by campus police and questioned about his presence as if he didn't belong there. Mm-hmm. He was carrying a book bag in one of those incidents and wearing a UNCW sweatshirt. And, of course, this isn't your fault by any stretch, but is this emblematic of some of the education that needs to happen about diversity on campus? What does this tell you about the climate?
I think climate is something that we're working on an ongoing basis. If someone of any persuasion is questioned for their presence on campus, I'm totally opposed to that. That is not the type of environment that we want to create. Our law enforcement our chief, in fact, is extremely sensitive to that. I know he shares with his people how to behave properly, so to speak, and how to watch out for sometimes, you know, inherent bias that people have. So I don't think the issue also is that How widespread is that? I meet African Americans, Muslims, Catholics on campus every day. And I can tell you, I see them smiling, I see them laughing, I see them going places, etc. So I think I wouldn't make one or two or three or, you know, examples as what is the climate university. I see a lot of people at the university. Every student I've ever met and every alumni I've met of UNCW, I have never, irrespective of race or color, I have never heard a comment from a student or an alum say, look, I had a horrible time there. Oh my God, I went to the UNCW, I was oppressed. Never heard this.
So this student's experience, you're saying, is an isolated.
Isolated. I don't think, you know, are we sure that everyone are having a great experience? Probably not. You know, that's life. You know, life is life. And we cannot, see, sometimes people think that we should create a bubble, a full safety bubble over every student. And in fact, if we did that, we would be doing a disservice to the students. Because as soon as they go out in the real world, that's not the bubble they're going to find. Now, that doesn't excuse our misbehavior in any way or form if for whatever reason we're misbehaving. We should be treating everyone with respect and dignity on campus, irrespective of anything.
Had you heard about this article that David
Kistner
published?
Yeah, I've heard about it, yeah.
And is that something that's triggered any kind of look at how campus police are being trained? Or
look, we've got we had some issues a couple of years ago, and we created a team, a task force, in fact, of multiple, you know, faculty, students, administrators, staff, and they've been working on a project which has got 10 actions, and we're pursuing that those vigorously. We've been addressing it, but I cannot, see, this is not North Korea. I cannot police every one of our folks on campus. I just can't do it. But we have to be talking about it. We want to make sure there are law enforcement, and not just law enforcement, it's administrators, it's staff, it's professors. How do we make sure that all of us treat each other decently? And that is job one, right? I would not use one or two or three or four cases to generalize. And this is one of the things that we do highly today, is we pick two or three examples and generalize to the rest of the population, which is not the case.
We hear criticism frequently of corporate America in that management and executives tend to make much more. There's a huge wealth gap between the top brass and the worker bees. We also hear criticism that way in academia. And in March of this year, Lauren Krauss, a graduate student at UNCW, wrote an opinion piece for the Raleigh News and Observer entitled, "As Academics Struggle, UNC Chancellors Prosper." And she points out, you know, students getting laden with tuition fees, leaving the university saddled in debt while adjuncts and grad students work for next to nothing. Professors lose their job to what she calls floundering newbies. She makes a case for this wealth gap and then starts pointing out the salaries that chancellors within the UNC system are making. You're now up to more than $355,000. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that a concern for you? Is she making a legitimate point that as universities move away from full-time professors and towards adjunct faculty and staff, part-timers, that there is this wealth gap being created?
We, and I'm using us as an example, we don't have as many adjuncts and lectures as other universities may have it, first. Secondly, this is another bubble concept of we're all going to be paid the same. And why should we be paid the same? This is, I'm a profound believer in free markets and capitalism, where we allow people to be, to maximize their potential. And if tomorrow we're going to be able to be observing that, okay, there should be a ratio between the boss and the supervisor, the only place that you would do that would be in a society that's not what I want to live in. A society where freedom predominates, liberty predominates. There will be differences. I think we have to have systems in place that if we see that the systems or those remunerations are unfair and not competitive and not market-driven, then we should correct it. But the idea that, well, you know, now we've got professors making very little money and the chancellor's making a lot of money, I think the money that people are willing to pay me is because they're looking at the market, they're looking at the other chancellors, and they're looking at my performance. And if they feel that I don't deserve that, they have two options, right? One is to reduce my salary, that they probably wouldn't do it, or fire me. And, you know, and they have that, the prerogative.
So you said that UNCW doesn't have as many adjunct right. staff as other campuses. Is it a trend, though? Is that the way the UNC system campuses are moving?
I don't think so. I don't see it, I remain to be corrected, but because I don't have all the data in front of me, but that has not been done on purpose, okay? None of my chancellors are saying, okay, we're going to start hiring only adjuncts now because we can pay less. Not even close to that. In fact, my effort here with all the money that we've got in terms of enrollment growth in the past 3 years has been to hire as many professors, full professors, tenure professors as possible. Now, sometimes you can't, and so temporarily you hire someone that can come in as a lecturer or as an adjunct, et cetera. But there's no quote-unquote chancellor conspiracy to only hire low-paying professionals to teach. Not the case. It may be people trying to create a storm in a teacup.
When we first spoke on Coastline 3 years ago, you talked about the importance of putting in a strategic plan by December of last year. That was your target. You now have a strategic plan in right. place for the five-year period from 2016 to 2021. One of the prongs of that plan, and I think you talked about this back then, was to contribute economically to the local community and then capture that impact. How are you doing on that front, and how do you see UNCW as contributing to the local economy?
Since I've been here, we've added, when I arrived, we had 14,500 students. We're up to almost 17,000 students. We've added almost 2,500, 3,000 students more. We're the fastest growing university in the system now, without compromising quality. Our SAT average has gone up to an all-time record this year, in fact, of 1251, which is terrific. So we've made a lot of great progress in terms of growing with quality, and we'll continue to do so. Some people may say, well, you know, you're growing too fast. Sometimes we are, sometimes we're not. This past year, we grew 300 students in total versus the year prior. The year prior, we had grown more. And we're not going to grow if we cannot afford to teach the same way we've taught for years, with high quality, providing a great amount of closeness between professor and students, ensuring great graduation, and so on and so forth. So I think all in all, the strategic plan has really guided us very well. The strategic plan also gave rise to our master plan. And in that master plan, within the next year or so, we'll have over $400 million under construction on campus, preparing the university for the future. This university probably, you know, as the area grows, you know, we're about 420,000 people now in the three counties. This three counties, by 2050, you're likely to be 700,000 to 1 million people. This is going to be a much bigger area, and the university is going to grow with it as we go forward.
And so if we zoom into that strategic plan, and just less than a minute left, 2019, what's the big rock that you want to make sure you put in the jar?
2019?
Yeah.
I'd like to have at least two of my major buildings underway, big time. One is the Veterans Hall, and we're working on it. And secondly, to start up our new housing village for our students.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Chancellor Sartorelli, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.